Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everyone. Welcome. Well, sorry, we're a little late running today. We couldn't get hold of our guests, but we're all set up now. And I'm pleased to have three great authors with us. You know, when my grandmother was born, few women in society had a voice. And most women writers were actually forced by their publishers to write under male pseudonyms. If you've heard of the books Middlemarch and The Mill on the Floss, you probably know the author as George Eliot. But George Eliot was really the pseudonym for Marianne Evans. The Bronte sisters, I think most people know that they wrote under a male name. They wrote as Currer, Ellis, and Acton Bell so that they could, quote, be taken seriously. And Louisa May Alcott started out writing dark suspense stories as Mr. A.M. Bernard. So those stories supported her financially while she pursued the writing that interested her and eventually led to Little Women. Well, I'm pleased today to say that all three of our ladies write under their own name. I'm assuming that at least they write under a female name. And so today we're celebrating women writers with three best-selling authors, all of whom have been written acclaimed books. Let me tell you who's coming up next. My first guest is Sarah Blake. She's written two noteworthy novels, among other writings. My other guests today are Andrea Kane, who's written 25 acclaimed novels and is currently on the New York Times bestseller list. And then we'll follow that with Ellen Hildebrand, who's also a New York Times bestseller with more than seven books under her belt. But first, I'm very pleased to welcome Sarah Blake, born in New York City. She's the author of a chapbook of poems, Full Turn, an artist book, Runaway Girls. And her first novel, Grange House, was named a new and noteworthy book back in 2001 by the New York Times. Her second novel, The Postmistress, is out now. And her essays and reviews have appeared in Good Housekeeping, U.S. News and World Report, the Chicago Tribune, and elsewhere. And Sarah taught high school and college English for many years in Colorado and New York. And she's also taught fiction workshops. She lives now in Washington, D.C. with her husband, the poet Joshua Weiner, and their two sons. Sarah Blake, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Well, I'm glad we connected with you. It's not a good feeling when you're going live on air and can't get hold of your guest. And that was absolutely no fault of yours, of course. Somebody along the way had given the wrong number to us. So
I'm so sorry.
I'm glad we connected with you. I wanted to talk about this because your first book was very acclaimed. You wrote it in 2001. Why wait till, I believe The Postmistress actually came out in 2010, but it's still going strong. Why wait so long to write another novel?
Well, I wish I could say that I waited. And I mean, the truth of the matter is that I was writing all of those 9 years in between. And The Postmistress, which did come out in 2010, was a very much more complicated story than I thought. And I love that you kicked off your introduction with the discussion of the Brontes and Marianne Evans, George Eliot, because I'm very very much influenced by the great storytellers of women's lives, and those Victorian novelists were absolutely front and center in my. In my coming to be a writer. And The Postmistress, you know, as you know, is a story of three women whose lives come together, and two of them are very much trying to tell the right story. Frankie Bard, who is a radio journalist, is trying to get the story of Europe before we enter World War II, and very much at a time when women were not allowed to, they certainly weren't, there were very, very few female broadcasters. Everybody knows Ed Murrow, but few people know Mary Breckinridge, who broadcast for him for just a little bit. And even the print reporters, it was definitely a time for the male story. And I was really interested in what does the war look like through women's eyes and through women writing. The story, and I did a lot of research on Martha Gellhorn, the great, great war reporter of the 20th century. So, in in many ways, the time that it took to write this novel was because I just kept getting deeper and deeper into how to tell the story of women who were trying to bring forward alternate pictures of what war looked like and alternate stories of the battlefield and you know, what is war off the battlefield? What would a war novel off the battlefield look like? So in fact, I was just writing sort of madly away every day and knocking my head against the wall. I didn't wait at all. I just, plunged right in, but it just took a long, long time.
Well, it obviously was worth it. So, but I heard that you got the idea for this when you were actually standing in the post office yourself and wondering, what kind of secrets are being passed through those letters and the responsibility that the postmistress has. And so tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the other major character is this woman who's Irish Dame. She's at the center of a small town in Cape Cod. And my husband and I were connected to a writing colony in Provincetown, Massachusetts. And so we lived there. My husband was a fellow there. We lived there for 3 years. And so it was a very small, small town in the winter. And everybody sort of knew, who everybody else was. It's a small fishing village. And I was completely distracted by what the woman who worked in the post office, what she knew about all of us. Because, of course, everything was going right through. Did she read our postcards? Because she could. I mean, there they were. And so then if she had secrets, what did she do with them? And so in my head, I was working on Grange House, my first novel at the time, but in my head suddenly came this image of a woman in a post office who pockets a letter instead of delivering it. And I just thought to myself, oh, yes, that is so, what a great, there's a novel, that's a whole novel. And then, about 3 years later when I came to write this, when I began The Postmistress, I started there and thought, the first obvious question was, well, what time would this have been? And I very cavalierly said, well, why don't I set it during World War II, because it would matter if a letter was, pocketed. We couldn't immediately
Absolutely.
Catch the news and
yeah.
catch up. So
the book covers everything, really. I mean, it covers, first women pioneers and in war correspondence. I actually didn't realize there were very many at all. There weren't very many at all, but I don't remember hearing about any when I was growing up because my grandparents, of course, went through the war and would tell us stories about it, and it was always men, men, men.
That's right. Well, it's true, and it was very, very interesting because there were not many, as you say. I mean, policy both in Britain and in America was that women were not allowed any farther for the front than nurses, so they couldn't actually go and report till very, very late in the war with what soldiers were doing. So they were telling other stories. I mean, Claire Hollingsworth, who is a British journalist, she was the one who broke Hitler's surprise march into Poland. She just, there were these women who
gutsy. I did not know that.
And they would just borrow cars and march across mountain ranges and just tell what they saw because they wanted to be there. Very often not at all attached to any, news agency until they had a story and then they would send it. So
yeah.
I mean, these really were unbelievable women.
Yeah, and they paved the way. I mean, and they're not people we hear about Diane Sawyer and Barbara Walters paving the way, but we have to go back a little further than that, don't we?
it's very true. They pushed open the door. I mean, World War II was the time when reporting did. There were lots and lots of doors opened, and women, pushed open, and many came through. But, it was very exciting.
Mm-hmm. Now, you use a real character in the book, deceased but real, Edward Moreau. Why use a real person?
Well, also, like setting it in real time or a real place, London and the Blitz. But Moreau, in some senses, gave me something real to sort of castellate around. He was such a hero in terms of broadcasting, and I realized that if I had him as a kind of backbone for my own fiction, it helped me write towards him and be, I think, in some ways, be more clear and more truthful in what my fiction was trying for.
Mm-hmm.
So it started off really for me, and then he definitely became very much his own character and a kind of voice of truth that Frankie, the journalist who is who he hires and who's my character, could kind of bounce off from. I mean, Frankie fails at what Moreau held up, which was objectivity in a time of war. But it's her failure that is that's the reason I wrote the novel. That was what was interesting to me as a fiction writer.
Right.
And yet to have a real character who, in fact, was very much center. I mean, he could have lost his objectivity, and he didn't. And that is a triumph. I think that's his triumph.
And, and of course, these three women's lives, even though they don't really connect, they intertwine very much so. Which of the characters, if any, are you most like?
I'm not really like, I mean, I wish I could say I was like Frankie Barra, this incredibly brave, intrepid, you know, journalist.
Alter ego.
But I'm not. I'm much more of a chicken, and I wouldn't make a good journalist because I'm way too polite, I think. But I think that all of them sort of set walking questions that I had, you know, that I wanted to kind of experience. And certainly for me as a writer, that's what I do. I want to see what it might feel like to ask these questions or put myself in these situations. So none of them are really me, but they're all after the sorts of things that I am. Iris James, the postmistress, you know, her faith in order as a way to prevent heartache is something, you know, I certainly am inclined to. And Emma, the third woman whom we haven't talked to, whose letter it is that is pocketed, that's withheld, she's an orphan, and her position is something that's very dear to my heart. The idea of when you grow up without parents, what does that set forth in you in terms of what you need from the world? And so her need for somebody watching over her is something that it's pretty close to me too. So
okay.
All three of them in a way.
Interesting. So did you grow up as an orphan?
My parents died when I was quite young. I mean, I was sort of in my teens and 20s.
Oh, that's
so
still very young.
I wasn't, you know, a Dickensian orphan. But you know, most of my adulthood was without grown-ups.
So. But that's where a lot of life experiences come into benefit, if there is a benefit to that. But you can draw on them later
that's
on
right.
With a little bit more objectivity, yeah.
Yeah, and I think also there's that model for what you might, you know, what does it look like to be a grown-up? And if it's not there, you're just sort of making a lot of things up, I think.
Right. So tell me what the creative process is like. We're almost at the end of our segment, unfortunately, but what's the creative process like for you, Sarah? It took you a long time to write this, as you said in the beginning. Is that because of family constraints or you just really needed to meander through this?
Well, I would say both. I mean, I do have two school-age children, so there's the usual flotsam and jetsam of life. I do write when they're at school, so I sort of set up very firm lines around that, but it's only about 5 or 6 hours a day. But, and then I do like to meander. I mean, I all of my novels, as it turns out, are set in other historical times, and so in order to get that sort of let my imagination take hold, I really need to understand what those worlds looked like and what the language of the time was. And so it involves a lot of research and a lot of kind of dreaming in another time. It's definitely, I'm not very good, it seems, at just putting one thing right in front of another. I'm much more interested in building patterns, which takes a little bit of time, I think.
Well, I know it was very acclaimed. The Postmistress is the book. It was a New York Times bestseller. What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Sarah?
Oh, it's just been really tremendous having this book out in the world and hearing the ways in which fiction has, you know, it's historical fiction, but it's set off so many people's memories of the time. So it's been wonderful that once again to see the power that something absolutely made up can have in the world and where fiction kind of walks. It's great.
Right. Well, I thank you for being with us today. And I know listeners can find out more about you at sarahblakebooks.com, correct?
That's right. That's right. Yes.
Thank you so much for being with us, Sarah.
Thank you, Vicky. That was fun.
And Sarah's book again, The Postmistress, a novel, you can find out more about her at sarahblakebooks.com. And Sarah has an H in it, The Postmistress. Beautifully written. Please do stay with us. When we come back, we're going to talk with Andrea Kane, another New York Times best-selling author, female author with a voice, as I said at the beginning. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Please stay tuned.
One life for yourself and one for your dream.
Next week on Conversations Live, she was a competitive ballroom dancer, a committed career nurse, and dedicated mother who began climbing in her 50s. Within less than a decade, she became the first woman over 60 to complete the 7 summits. How did she do it? What is it that makes Kayla Clair go the distance? That's the secret she'd like to share with you. Join us next Monday at noon Pacific on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Making a difference, one word at a time.
Alternative Talk 1150 is on the interwebs. Dial us up at 1150kknw.com.
And life seems tame till one dream appears and love is its name.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And today we're celebrating women in fiction. As I said at the top of the hour, it wasn't so long ago that women writers could not write under their own name. They had to write under a male name. And in fact, as recent as Harry Potter, J.K. Rowling was told that if she wrote under her own name of Joanne, then boys probably weren't going to like her book or buy into her book. So that's how they came up with the J.K. Rowling. She has no middle initial K, apparently. Pleased to say all of our writers today do write under female names. And we're joined next by Andrea Kane. She has a worldwide following with novels published in over 20 languages. She has written, to my calculations, around 25 books. Her most recent triumphs, Twisted and Drawn in Blood, feature the dynamic FBI team of special agents Sloane Burbank and Derek Parker. And her latest work, The Girl Who Disappeared Twice, hit the New York Times bestseller list just 5 days after its release. And Andrea lives in with her family in New Jersey. Andrea Kane, welcome.
Oh, my pleasure to be here today, Vicky.
Well, I want to congratulate you, first of all, on your success on the New York Times bestseller list, I think, again.
Oh, thank you so
but
much.
I know you celebrated by eating way too much ice cream, I read.
Yeah, that's exactly what I said. That's always the rule in our family. Where other people like to go out and have champagne, we have ice cream.
Well, I hope you've recovered from that now, because this is a fairly recent event for you. The book came out last month, right?
Yes, it did.
Yeah. So, well, tell us a little bit about the book, first of all. The Girl Who Disappeared Twice. You've got quite an eclectic team in there. And I was saying at the beginning of the show how women used to, if they wrote these kind of books, always had to write under a male name to be taken seriously. Fortunately, you didn't have to do that. So tell us a little bit about this eclectic team. You used to write historical romances. Why the switch?
Well, first of all, it's interesting because I never really felt like it was a switch. I felt more like it was a metamorphosis because mm-hmm. I wrote historical romantic suspense. I've always had suspense in everything. And one day the calling just seemed to be, you know, the muse, the writing muse that just takes you in another direction. I just knew that it was time to move to contemporary, and that's what I started to do. As far as The Girl Who Disappeared Twice, it's the first time that, and I'm very excited about it, that I've taken on a team as opposed to just a female and a male protagonist, and it's a very, as you said, it's a very eclectic team. They're all, as I call them, maverick investigators. Each of them come on with a different skill, and together they are the go-to team when everybody is a situation where, unfortunately, the regular law enforcement is constrained by rules, and they need to get, in this particular case, a little girl is kidnapped. She's 5 years old. Her parents are desperate, and they want to cover every base imaginable, so they call Forensic Instincts, who is the team that we're talking about, and Forensic Instincts goes to it in their own unique and interesting way.
And how did you come up with the storyline? I mean, what drove you to this particular group of people and this particular storyline?
Well, as far as the storyline, I kept thinking about a traumatized person who was already traumatized that had to already, that again, had to go through a similar trauma, because that's the situation, hence the title, with the mother, Chrissy's mother, Hope, who had to live through the traumatic situation of having her twin sister kidnapped from Mike right beside her when they were 6 years old, and now she's living a nightmare again with her own daughter. So it's the horror of her own nightmare repeating itself and the wonder if there's a connection. And it just seemed like a really a fascinating way to go about a kidnapping of a child as opposed to the usual. As far as the team, I've always been fascinated with psychological aspect. I always say I write psychological thrillers because the human mind is so amazing to me and how it works. So Casey, who's the president and founder of Forensic Instincts, is a behavioral specialist, and she can talk to people or watch their body language and just sort of instinctively get a feel for what's going on when they're lying, when they're telling the truth, if there's something going on that they're not revealing. So that's where I started. And then the rest of the team came together because it was just, I work with the FBI a lot when I do my research. So I knew that one of them had to be former FBI, and as it turned out, he was former Navy SEAL. And then, of course, they needed strategic techno wizard who was going to be able to handle everything there. And then my favorite part, bringing in
a four-legged
hero. Scent recovery dog. So he's a human scent evidence dog from the FBI, and he's awesome.
Yeah, I think it's always more nerve-wracking to me when the dog is more likely to get injured. I actually watched a film yesterday, and it was a horrific scene, and I actually closed my eyes through most of it. But what worried me most was that the goldfish got knocked out of the bowl.
You know? I'm the same way. I've never gotten over Charlotte's Web.
So tell us, you mentioned that you do a lot of research at the FBI, and I was looking at your website, and I thought this made me laugh. I'm somebody who doesn't like guns myself, but you say loading a Glock 22 magazine is just like loading a Pez dispenser, except much harder.
I made the whole FBI start to laugh, too, because I kept asking them what it was like, and it's very difficult to describe it. I guess they don't think with the same creative sort of strange mind that I do, but I was loading it, and it's that kind of slide in and make vertical and slide down one on top of the other, and that's all I kept thinking. This is just like a Pez dispenser, right down to the fact that the last one won't go in no matter how hard you try.
Yeah. So you actually went into the FBI, as I understand it, as a NAT, an agent in training, as an ANT. Is it ANT?
Not officially, but what I got a chance to do was I went down as a visiting sort of a trainee, because I got a chance to watch them perform hostage negotiations and take part in not doing them, but actually observing them. I didn't actually do them, but it was fascinating to watch. I got to talk to the behavioral analysis unit. With this one, the crimes against children units, it's absolutely amazing how brilliant they are and how each of them is unique and different. The different units each do different things, and it's sort of like having a brand new learning experience, or learning a new career each time I start a book.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I think that must be part of the fun of writing novels like that. I think I do nonfiction. I think it'd be much more fun to go out and experience some fiction stuff sometimes.
Well, that's incorporating the research in, which is the nonfiction part, and it is really fascinating.
Because, true. You
know, I always felt like when I did all the situation with the loading, because I was terrified. I mean, I also have never shot a gun until then, and it wasn't something that came naturally to me. And I had this awful feeling, I have life in my hands, and what if I shoot and instead of hitting the target, it goes off in the woods, it hurts an animal or something. I was so frightened.
Yeah.
But I really felt that, because in that case, my character had an injury where she couldn't shoot, and I needed to understand how to shoot and what kind of pressure was necessary to pull the trigger and all those kinds of things.
Yeah, and I loved this, and then we'll move off the FBI training, but I love this on your website. You said old habits are hard to break. You're right there in the middle of this FBI training center, and you kept locking your car door.
I did, and they kept saying to me, you're with the FBI, you don't need to worry, because Hogan's Alley is this made-up place, but it's real. It's a real town, and you do feel when you park your car like you have to go through the rituals that you normally would.
Right, right. So you've written, I think, 25 novels. Is that correct?
I 23 novels and 2 novellas, so yes, yeah. Basically 25.
Yeah, I saw you have a shopping list on your website, which I think would be very useful for people who want to check out. This is the problem when I read authors who've written a lot of books. I get to a point where I can't remember which ones I've read. But you've taken care of that. You provided a shopping list on your website, which
for
I thought was good.
For the exact reason that you said. It's very difficult.
Absolutely.
Titles are wonderful, but after a while they kind of meld together and you can't remember which you've read and which you haven't. Mm.
So have you always written, Andrea? Have you had other jobs beside writing?
Well, I have always written. And what's interesting is that when I got out of college, I never thought of myself as like a novelist. It wasn't the kind of thing where I thought I could write a whole book. I knew I loved to read. I knew I loved to write. So what I did was I got a job actually at the other end. I was working at a publishing house as an editorial assistant. So I got a chance to see it from the other end, although I didn't realize that one day I would be able to do this.
Right, right. Well, I think that's probably a good insight into what people are looking for.
Yes, it definitely is. Plus, you learn all the copy edit symbols and things like that, which are very helpful later on.
Mm-hmm. So let's go way back when you first wrote your very first book then. And how did you go about getting an agent? And what was that process like for you? Did you think it would really happen?
It's frightening all the way through. And I always thought, actually, when I got to this point, it would stop being frightening. But it still isn't. Because when you're successful, then your thought is, what if the next book isn't better? It's just a driving force of most writers, I think. And I just sort of comfort myself with the idea that if I ever become complacent, that's when I'll write a bad book. So I have to always be worried and I have to always be nervous. But the beginning, I knew that I was going to finish it. I can't honestly say that I was positive that I would publish it, but I knew that once I start something, I can't stop till I'm finished.
Right.
So I did write the book, and then after that, I still am actually affiliated with 3 or so different writers organizations, and I set up a meeting with an agent and with an editor, and they both expressed interest, so I sent them in, and I was very fortunate. I mean, it didn't happen right away. It was a long process. It never happens right away. There are very few people that just, you know, have good luck right off the bat. It's a waiting period. It's a hoping period. And it's a rejection period.
Yeah.
Getting letters from people saying, I really liked your book, but we don't have any place for it on our list, that kind of thing. And
mm-hmm.
I always say it's kind of like having a baby and having people tell you it's ugly. It's very, very hard to take because it's so personal to you.
Right. So how did you and how do you deal with rejection?
It's difficult. It's very hard because this business is 2 sides. It's creative and it's business. So separating the two is a very difficult thing, but you have to in order to succeed. You need to understand that as much as you love your baby, it needs to be marketable. Otherwise, it's just not going to work. So with my editor, I work really well. When I get back edits at the beginning, I always give myself one day to run around the house cursing and screaming and crying. And then when all that's done, then I sit down and I go down to business and look at it, and I usually find that there's a lot of merit to it.
Right.
And I separate from the emotional, this is my baby and how dare you, to God, you're good at what you do, and together we're going to make this an amazing book.
Right.
The only thing that's still very, very hard that I don't deal well with are the really cruel reviews. Not the negative ones that have merit, but the cruel ones, the anonymous ones on the web where people just rip you to shreds.
Mm-hmm.
I try very hard to stay away from reading those.
Yeah, and I think if somebody does that kind of thing anonymously, it doesn't bear any credence, quite honestly.
No, I hope that's the truth.
So tell me, what does discipline mean to you? What does creativity mean to you, Andrea?
Well, discipline to me has always come very easy because I'm one of those diehard Taurians that, you know, I'm very structured by nature. I think people who write thrillers and suspense are structured to a certain extent because you need to write an outline, you need to follow at least some sort of a plan, even though it changes a lot throughout the book. I mean, you end up going in different directions. But you need to have red herrings in mind. You need to have dips, ebbs, and flows in the plot. And you need to also, because characterization is so important to me, everything stems from the characters, you need to have important things happen to the characters at a different time than something really major happening in the plot. So if someone is coming to a life crisis, you're not going to have a dead body hit the floor at the exact same time because the reader, it's like darting in different directions. They don't know where to go. So the creativity is the meandering meandering that happens once the outline is finished, that you accept that, you know, the outline is two-dimensional, and once the book is being written, it's three-dimensional, so the characters sort of take over, and you need to go where they go.
Right, right. Now, Casey Woods, you mentioned her earlier. She's the intuitive leader in this team of forensic instincts, called the Forensic Instincts, in the book. Is there any of you in Casey? I know when you went through the FBI training, you said it was fantastic because you were with a whole bunch of other type A's.
That's definitely true. And I think that's probably what, I was actually just going to say exactly that, that's probably what Casey and I most have in common. That very type A personality that always thinks that unless I do it, it won't get done right.
Right.
So I, not because I think I'm so brilliant, but because I think that I know that when I apply myself, it gets done, and it gets done to my satisfaction. I think that's also the discipline that Casey has that I have. I write every day. I don't ever feel like when people say to me, how do you make yourself? I just do. That's my job. I go to my office, and I sit down, and I write, and I don't let anything interfere with it.
Yeah. Now, when you say every day, you mean 7 days a week, or you have a proper work week, like 5 days a week?
I don't have a proper work week. I have a ridiculous work week. I usually write 7 days a week,
wow.
But not... Well, I mean, there'll be days where I'll write an hour. There'll be days that I don't write, but I research all day because it's not coming creatively, so I turn to the research instead. And then there are days where all day long I'll stare at a blank page, nothing will really come, and then in the middle of the night I'll get up and start writing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sort of a mixed bag. I mean, I can't. It's not like an eight-hour work day when you go to a corporation and you sit down at your desk at 9 and work till 5. I wish it would work that way, but the creative process usually... doesn't cooperate. 3 in the morning, a wonderful idea occurs to you.
Right.
And if you don't get up, I've learned that if you don't get up and act on it right away, it's gone in the morning.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, even when you tell yourself you're going to remember.
Exactly.
Now, Lisa Gardner, who's a very well-known author too, said that Andrea Kane set standards for suspense. Who were your biggest influences in the writing world?
Back to, I think, the days that I read the original Robert Ludlum's, I would say that was my first exposure to what I would call, you know, suspense thrillers. And I was just fascinated, not just by his characters, but by how much he knew. Yeah, I always had this feeling that he had some inside information until I realized that he just probably did extensive research. You know, unfortunately, he's not with us anymore, mm-hmm. but he was a brilliant writer, and his books definitely inspired me in a lot of ways. I've always, you know, back to the days of my Nancy Drew days, I was always, you know, sort of, I always found mysteries really exciting, and I always wanted to try to solve them beforehand, and sometimes did and sometimes didn't. Sometimes even if you know who did it or you figured it out, it's exciting to watch the characters determine that and unfold. And, you know, that feeling where you want to yell out, don't do it, because if you do, it's on the other side of the door,
right.
Someone who wants to kill you.
Right, right, right.
There's that feeling.
Yeah, good. Well, what kind of things make you jump out of bed with excitement in the morning? Well, we're talking about screaming.
Usually when I think of something, it's character-based. There'll be something where I'll think, it would be awesome if this character did this, or this particular thing would be amazing to see happen. It's either a really unique idea, or it's something that the character would do that I didn't anticipate, is it in my outline, and really wasn't planned, but it usually the day before, I'm stuck. It's that day where I'm sort of digging, and I sort of hit a rock, and I just can't get past it, and it's time to stop and say it's not happening the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And then something wonderful will come in the middle of the night, and I'll jump out of bed and think, hallelujah, it happened.
Right. You have a whole list of frequently asked questions on your website, and one of them is, you know, what advice do you give to writers? But I want to know, with the success that you've had, what's the best career advice that you've received?
I think probably the fact that a writer writes no matter what, that when this is something that you do, and now that's the business side of it. The other side of it is love what you do, because this is not a business where you wake up on the New York Times. I know, unfortunately, there are people who believe that, but it's something where
right.
you don't do it because you want to make lists or you want to make a lot of money. You do it because it's there. It's inside you. It's kind of who I am, not what I do. And consequently, you know, I do it because I love it. And I always say to people, if this is not what you burn to do, don't do it, because it's just a very difficult career.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I know from the 10 years that I've been interviewing people for print articles, for books, for the radio, I know there's no such thing as an overnight success. Every single one of those people who's become really successful has paid their dues. And
oh, yes.
Now they can bask a little in the glory. So congratulations again to you.
Thank you so much.
Sure. What would you like to leave our listeners with today, Andrea?
I think the fact that, to start out what you just said, that women can do anything, that there's no doubt in our mind. Fortunately, the world has allowed us more, but women can definitely do anything. In fact, I think sometimes women make the most empathetic writers imaginable because they could create the most full-bodied characters. And just to combine that level of excitement and to combine those kinds of characters is really the joy of my life. And when I get letters from people telling me that it made a difference to them, that it gave them, even if it's just respite when they're going through a rough time, that's a legacy unto itself. That's a wonderful thing.
Great. Thank you so much. And listeners can find out more about you at AndreaKane.com, correct?
Absolutely.
And Kane is spelled with a K, AndreaKane.com. A new book on the New York Times bestseller list right now, The Girl Who Disappeared Twice. Happened once, it happened again. It's very good. Thanks so much for being with us, Andrea. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
And please stay with us. When we come back, we'll be talking with Ellen Hildebrand. Kirker's Reviews hails her as the queen of the summer novel. We're going to take a trip to Nantucket next. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
You're listening to Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
Sail on, silver girl. Sail on.
And welcome back, everyone. Well, we are celebrating women in fiction today, women who use their own names, or at least a female name, because as I said at the beginning of the show and throughout the show, it wasn't too long ago that women could not write under their own names. They had to use a male name. A couple of other examples there. Nora Roberts is a very famous author, and she wrote under J.D. Robb for many years because she wrote a different kind of genre. But by then, when people found out, I think she was so popular, they just embraced it, and they know that who she is now. So it's not really a pseudonym anymore. And of course, somebody local to the Seattle area, and very well known up here, Anne Rule, oh, very well known everywhere, I think, Anne Rule, for many years wrote as Andy Stack, because it was thought that people would take that more seriously than a woman. So anyway, moving on to my next guest, Ellen Hildebrand. She lives on Nantucket with her husband and their three young children. She grew up in Collegeville, Pennsylvania. She traveled extensively before settling on Nantucket, which has been the setting for her five previous novels. She's a graduate of Johns Hopkins University and the Graduate Fiction Workshop at the University of Iowa. Welcome to the show, Ellen Hildebrand.
Thank you very much.
And I want to say, as Eric played us in there with Simon and Garfunkel's Bridge Over Troubled Water, your book is called Silver Girl. You're also the author of the bestsellers Barefoot and The Island. And this, as I said, Kirkus Reviews said, hailed you as the queen of the summer novels. How does that make you feel?
Oh, well, you know, I love it. I absolutely love it.
So tell us, take us back a little, because you've traveled a lot. When did you first start writing, Ellen?
Oh, I first started writing when I was 7 or 8 years old, and I remember being in second grade, and my teacher gave everyone an award at the end of the school year, and my award was the top author award. And as soon as she said that, I thought, yes, I'm an author. And it, like a light bulb came on, and I knew it, and I felt it. And so I've always wanted to write and have never, ever wanted to do anything else.
It's so funny, because when I was about 8 or 9, I lost my wallet, which my grandmother, I lived in England, my grandmother had sent it to me from America, and I made myself some little business cards in there. And on one side, it said freelance journalist. And on the other side, it said freelance writer, because I couldn't decide which I needed to be when I was growing up. So tell us a little bit about the book, Silver Girl. It's a very intricately woven story based on Nantucket. Tell us in your own words a little bit about the story.
Well, my story is about a woman named Meredith DeLynn, whose husband commits massive, massive financial fraud.
Timely.
And I got the idea from the novel. I read the New York Times Sunday Style section in April of 2009. There was an article called The Loneliest Woman in New York, and it was about Ruth Madoff and how she'd lost everything and lost all of her friends and all of her money and couldn't go anywhere and couldn't leave her house and was a complete outcast. And the article really pierced me, and I thought, okay, if she's conspiring with her husband, this is not interesting. But if she didn't know what Bernie Madoff was doing, then this is biblically tragic. And I decided that I wanted to write a novel about a woman in her position who was innocent. And one of the details in that article, it said that Mrs. Madoff has one friend from preschool who has stood by her side. And I thought to myself, now what is it like to be that woman? And from there came this novel. My character, Meredith, loses everything and is a complete outcast and is still under investigation. And she appeals to her longtime best friend from growing up named Connie. And because it's an Ellen Hildebrand novel, Connie lives on Nantucket and brings Meredith to Nantucket for the summer.
So why Nantucket? Obviously, you live there, but you've traveled extensively and, you know, presumably could write about many, many places. You've traveled on 6 continents, I believe.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That is very true. Nantucket is an incredibly, you know, unique and authentic place. It's, for those of you in Washington who have never been here, it's got, you know, it's 4 miles by 13 miles. It's got cobblestone streets, a historically preserved downtown, Quaker meeting houses, 50 miles of pristine beach. It's a very nurturing place. It's 30 miles off the coast. And it is my home, and it is the place that I write about. And I really felt like for Meredith, it would be a good place to have her come get away from it all. Now, as it turns out, you know, Nantucket also has the distinction of being the home to very many wealthy people. Mm-hmm. And so she finds more of her husband's investors living on Nantucket than she probably would have cared for. and that adds to sort of the plot. But I think by the end of the book, she does really connect with the place and love the place in the same way that I do and many others do.
Right. Ideal place for healing because of the nurturing environment. And that's really the part of the story that's woven through is the healing of not just Meredith herself, but also the relationship with her long-lost girlfriend, basically.
Yep.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So are either of these characters representative of you? Are you in either of these characters?
A little bit. People, of course, always ask that. And,
yep.
You know, it's hard to explain the difference between fiction and real life. Fiction is crafted in a way that makes sense, narrative sense, in which real life does not make narrative sense. And that's sort of a hard concept to grasp. So I never put real, actual people in my books because they don't make sense in a crafted narrative. But I do use details about real people. So in this novel, you know, there's a little bit of me in Connie and a little bit of me in Meredith. I'm a very good cook, an avid cook, I guess I'd say, just like Connie. As far as Meredith goes, one aspect of Meredith is that she has this relationship with her father, and her father dies when she's a teenager, and he sings her the song Silver Girl, and that's all borrowed from my own life. My father died when I was in high school, and mm-hmm. It was very, very difficult for me, and he used to sing the song Bridge Over Troubled Water to me, and those lyrics, you know, 25 years later, you know, I've been a real source of comfort. It was a gift that he gave me, and so I'm now the same age that he was when he died, and I've got children, and so it's this, you know, Silver Girl was this whole sort of catharsis of sort of, you know, writing about his death from Meredith's point of view.
Mm-hmm. How do you go about working? Do you outline, like Andrea Kane, our previous guest? Is it more of an organic process for you?
It's organic. I'll spend, at the very beginning of a novel, I'll spend 3 or 4 pages taking notes, writing down notes about the characters and who I think they are. And I have a general idea of how I want things to go, sort of almost markers, milestones in my head, but I don't write an outline because so many times I'm writing and things will happen. You know, the characters will say something or do something or, you know, that surprise me. And it's a very mystical process. And I always say I'm not a mystical person, but I do not question how this happens. But as I'm writing, things just sort of reveal themselves because you're with the characters and you're in their heads. And, yeah. And they, you know, they say and do surprising things sometimes. And it would be nothing that I would have been able to outline from the beginning.
Yeah. And I imagine that's a very exciting process when suddenly something is revealed.
Every time it happens, I just say to myself, look at that. Look what they're doing.
So you have two young boys, I believe. Is that correct?
I have two boys and a girl.
Two boys and a girl. So how do you balance being a wife, being a mother, being an author?
I just live in complete insanity. Complete insanity. My two boys play Little League Baseball. And for anybody out there who is a Mariners fan, I mean, they're both on the All-Star team. So it's, my life, I always say, is like 70% baseball and 30% writing or something like that. It's hard. And you know, I just make sure that I carve out my writing time for myself, and that has to be absolutely silent and alone. And, you know, that I treat it just like, you know, an office or an office job where I go and I work, and mom's working and I'm not available as I'm at work. And I just have to stand up for myself in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Who has inspired you as a writer, and who has inspired you as a woman?
Those are interesting questions. As a writer, I'm incredibly inspired by Toni Morrison, Jane Smiley, Lori Moore. Those are my three favorites. I read a lot of contemporary fiction. I'm just starting the new Ann Patchett. I like to read really, really good books. As far as a woman is concerned, I love Anna Quinlan as well. As far as a woman is concerned, I really admire my mother. She was a single mother after my father died and raised the three of us. I have two brothers and did an incredibly good job, and we all turned out pretty well. And I'm incredibly impressed that, you know, I have a husband and a nanny, and sometimes the three of us can't get the three kids out the door. and so I'm amazed and impressed that she was able to do it by herself.
Yeah, I'm always amazed when I'm with friends and we have to get, like, you know, six little bodies out the door. It's like being in an army. I know you've traveled extensively. We talked about that. You obviously chose Nantucket, and I've read that you would not want to live anywhere else. But if you had to live somewhere else other than Nantucket, where would that be?
Oh, well, we've traveled so much, and we've spent winters on Nantucket are a little bit tough. We've spent five of the last nine winters in Fremantle, Australia.
Which, oh, wow.
Like you, is on the West Coast. It's on the West Coast of Australia, uh-huh. And it's about as far from Nantucket as you can get. It is another authentic, incredibly magical place. It's a seaside town with Cappuccino Strip and very cafe culture, and it's got gorgeous weather. And so very close second to Nantucket. I absolutely love it there.
Mm-hmm. What, if any, are, you know, I think when you've traveled a lot and you're raising kids, a lot of life answers get answered. Are there any big life unanswered questions for you that you're working out?
Life unanswered questions that I'm working out? Yes. I mean, well, one of the things I'd really like to be able to do is I'd like to be able to read other people's minds. And
hey, let me know when you can do that. It'd be fun.
One of the things, I think it's in the book I'm writing now, that the characters say, life is so frustrating because you can never tell what someone else is thinking.
I know.
And
maybe that's a good thing.
You know, maybe it is a good thing, but it is, you know, basically it's my job to be able to get into other people's heads and explain what they're thinking. And so in real life, I find it so frustrating that, in fact, you know, when you're dealing with people on a day-to-day basis and you're thinking, what are they thinking? And you just have no idea. And then the other one of life's unanswered questions, which will never be answered, which I'm trying to, you know, grapple with my kids, and anyone who has kids will understand this, is what happens when we die? They ask, Mommy, what happens when we die? And I say, we do not know. Nobody knows. And that is just an impossible thing for them to grapple with.
Yeah. And it's. I think it's a universal question, too.
Absolutely.
So what's next for you? You just mentioned you were writing your next book.
Yes, I'm on a yearly schedule with Little Brown. So I have a book coming out next summer, which I'm finishing now, and it is about teenagers. It's about four teenagers living in Nantucket, and there was a spate of suicides here two or three years ago where five or six kids at the high school killed themselves. And it's not about that, but it put into my head the question about what it's like to be on Nantucket, what it's like to be growing up on Nantucket, to be a teenager on Nantucket when it's so small, and And so I wrote about four teenagers and their parents, and it's been fascinating. I don't have, my kids are not teenagers yet, so sort of delving into new territory.
Interesting. And a question I always like to ask authors is how you deal with rejection, because we all have rejection in life. How do you deal with it?
I've become quite the expert, I have to say. You know, not everybody, I remember my fourth book was called The Blue Bistro, and we tried to get the Philadelphia Inquirer to review it, and when they did review it, they totally panned it. It couldn't have been worse. And it was everybody's, it's my favorite book still to this day, and everybody, you ask Ellen Hildebrand fans, which is your favorite book, they say The Blue Bistro, but Philadelphia Inquirer absolutely panned it.
Oh, gosh.
And I thought to myself, okay, this is like the worst thing, because now 800,000 people are, you know, have now seen that my book stinks. But the great thing about that review was that after I got past that, I thought to myself, you know what? You win a few, you lose a few. Not everybody's going to like it. And I have really, one thing I have learned in this business is to take that kind of rejection in stride.
Mm-hmm.
People don't like it. Some people love it. You know, I've been enormously successful, and I can only just be so grateful for what I do have.
Right, right. What do you tell young people or older people who come to you, anyone who comes to you and says they have a book in mind? I'm sure
yes.
You get fed up of asking this question.
It happens all the time, probably, you know, three or four times a week. I say, you know, make it a priority. Start at the beginning, move to the end. Do not stop. You know, a lot of people get to the, you know, the nebulous middle
yeah.
and feel like they don't know where to go next, and they give up and they stick it in a drawer. And how many times has that happened? So I always say, you know, if you're serious about it, keep going, make it a priority. You know, give yourself the time and space to do it, and then you must finish. And that is the best piece of advice I have.
I think when you say that I think of I'm reminded of Neil Simon, who shoved a play in the drawer and found it 10 years later. He shoved it in the drawer because he thought it was rubbish, shoved it in the drawer, and 10 years later it became Brighton Beach Memoirs.
Right, exactly.
Well, we're right at the end of our show now. Where can people find out more about you? I think it's ellenhildebrand.net, correct?
Yes, that's right. I'm online at ellenhildebrand.net, and I'm on Twitter at ellenhildebrand. And
okay.
I love it. I'd love to hear from everybody.
Thank you so much, Ellen, for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
And my guest again, Ellen Hildebrand, her book, Silver Girl. All of her books have been written on Nantucket. It makes you want to move there. It's probably a good thing that it's a small island, because it would be very busy otherwise with all of us moving there. Before I go today, I just want to tell you of an event that's coming up on August 9th. We've talked with Andy Cernovitz a couple of times. His website is gaspedal.com. He specializes in word-of-mouth marketing. If you have a small business or service you're interested in promoting, he's putting together, he's actually joining with several others and putting How Big Brands, it's called Blog Well, How Big Brands Use Social Media. It's here in Seattle, August 9th, 1 to 5 p.m. If you want to go, you can use a discount code. He gave me a discount code. It's called Vicky Sent Me. Vicky sent me, and it will get you 33% off the registration price. And we're almost at the end of our show now, so I'm going to tell you, if you want any more information about that, you know where to reach me, info@conversationslive.net, and I'll give you all that detail then, info@conversationslive.net. Or you can call the 800 number, 800-495-7617. 495-7617. Thank you so much for being with us today. And hope you enjoyed celebrating with me that women have a voice now in publishing and they don't have to hide behind a man's name. Thanks for being with us. Live well, live strong.
Next week on Conversations Live, she was a competitive ballroom dancer, a committed career nurse, and dedicated mother who began climbing in her 50s. Within less than a decade, she became the first woman over 60 to complete the 7 summits. How did she do it? What is it that makes Kayla Clare go the distance? That's the secret she'd like to share with you. Join us next Monday at noon Pacific on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.